Session number 12251, Mr. S. Wood, Reel 3.
Mr. S.D. Wood, Reel 3. What were these southern country lads like after being used to north country people, Mr. Wood?
Well, actually, they were mostly, you could call them Londoners, because as I said before, they were quite a lot of them were battalion like our original TA, and a lot of them worked with the South Eastern Gas Board. And I got on very well with them. By and large, there was obviously the odd one who was, which you got in any setup, who was a bit bolshy, but by and large I had very little problems with them as men and individuals, and we got on very well.
Did you have a batman?
Yes, a batman, Jimmy Green, used to work for Sutton Seed people in Reading, I always remember that. And he was a very, put it bluntly, canny lad was Jimmy. It just suited him down the ground. And I don't know whether I should mention it, but Jimmy had an unfortunate complaint. He had the most awful set of buck teeth you ever could see. And it so happened on our site headquarters, the military dentist turned up to check everybody, as they did periodically, or for medical checkups as well as dental. And he arranged to have Jimmy sent down to the Aldershot Hospital. And he did a marvellous arrangement whereby they removed his teeth and straightened them up. They came back, and I've never seen a lad's outlook change so totally and completely as a result of the kindness of the dental officer that put Jimmy back on the road again, where he felt he could go out without being stared at or made fun of. No, he was very good.
What duties did you expect from your batman? What was his duty?
Well, his basic duty was just looking after my uniforms and bringing my food into my little quarters we had huts then, from the kitchen, and looking after my equipment and clothing.
Did you find it difficult or embarrassing in some way, getting used to that after having been on the other side so long?
No, it just came along. One was obviously instructed when doing the officer training, but being such helpful people around you, you didn't feel as if it was something unusual. In other words, it was just part and parcel of the job.
So there's no problem with discipline with you?
Not really, no. I think we had the odd one. The only one who causes any bother was the one who was a bit of a Romeo and had women coming at the gate, whatever village we went to. They were always coming asking for the same fella, so obviously he was. But apart from that, I can't recall having take any serious disciplinary action against any members of the troop that I was in control of. Now, there was about half a dozen searchlights and probably quite a lot of lads involved. But also received wonderful treatment from the villages, because we were in country areas in Ticehurst and Etchingham, Bodger. And if we went in the village, and I mean, people used to leave stuff at the gate, or they'd invite you out, because in the daytime we had a certain amount of free time, obviously. It was night time we were doing our work. And in Ticehurst in particular, it was very interesting, because that was very adjacent to the hop fields. And even during the war years, the cockneys used to come down into the hop fields to pick the hop crops, you know, for the beer and the brewing industry. So we saw quite a lot of those people in that area. And another interesting sideline, if you can call it, in the village pub, we went down there, as it so happened, on New Year's Eve, and the village parson was there, and it was an idyllic village scene, a village green, a little pub. And it happened to be New Year's Eve, and they said, I happened to say, well, isn't anybody doing any first footing? And I was rather surprised at one dear lady who said, "I've never heard that mentioned, lad, since I came down here. Would you like to be my first foot?" And obviously she was a North Country lass who'd gone down there. And we did first footing. And now, resulting from that, her husband was a farmer. As I said before, when they were picking the hops in the hop fields, the first crop of hops going into the host house for turning and treatment is like first footing, and they invite the people from one farm to another, and they have a glass of cider, and everybody tosses. So I resulted that I learned more about the hop industry and the first footing, like the host house business, at first hand from the villagers. But and even the local butcher, I remember him very clearly, a wonderful guy called Reg Fields. The local parson used to, and at that stage, funny enough, we were lucky. They'd even allocated us a cottage, and we actually lived in a cottage for a brief while we're in that particular area. They thought that the wooden sheds weren't good enough for us, and the people were very good indeed, first class.
Did you have to continue a lot of training to keep yourselves up to scratch?
Well, there was nothing really new as far as the searchlights were going, but what was new was the radar equipment for attachment to the searchlight instead of the separate listening unit we'd been used to from day one. So obviously, the electricians and other laddies had to go on courses for operating and servicing the radar units, which were positioned on either side of the searchlight, so in two bucket seats, whereas opposed to the other control, which used to come from the ordinary headphone hearing setup. So courses were run for those people, and then everybody was instructed on site on the operation of the radar unit attached to the searchlight, which appeared as a, if you pointed that up in the sky at night and there was a sort of a blue ribbon line running across this black face, if a blip appeared on there, obviously there was an object moving, and you swung or moved the searchlight till you got it parallel running along that line, and then obviously you threw the switch and hopefully illuminated the aircraft.
Was it efficient equipment?
In the early stages, obviously it had its snags. It was like everything else. It was evaluation, and that being the busiest bomber route from the northern French coast, particularly Abbeville, which was a big bomber base then with the Germans being on there, that was the direct route into London for the nightly bombings of London, so we had a fair amount of traffic going through. So we had plenty of opportunities in, we learned as we went along, because we were in action most nights. It was only when there was what you call 10/10th cloud, where air or mist, where the bomber couldn't take off or couldn't even penetrate the cloud to see where they were going to do the bombing, that we were stood down and had any relief. But on a normal night, we're at it most nights.
You've mentioned the screen and how it worked. What did the equipment look like? How big was it?
Well, the unit on the side of that would be probably about 18 inches wide and about 9 inches deep. And it was like a black screen with knobs on, like a miniature television set, if you can think, but of an oblong shape. And there were aerials pointing out from the side of the searchlight to pick up the signals to be relayed back into this little sort of TV screen, which was black, which had a blue ribbon line running along, which, when the signal picked up, appeared as a blip on there going along the line.
And you said in the beginning that it had its teething problems.
Well, you know, it was difficult to tune it in and get everything coordinated, and but, you know, we were in action so often that it didn't take long to get it in operation, because they would say the only time that we didn't operate was when the weather conditions precluded even planes being able to take off or fly without locating their actual targets.
What was the kind of speed between, or a time taken once you got an alarm, between the sleeping, whatever you were doing, and then getting rigged up?
Well, there was always somebody, there was always a guard on, there was also somebody standing by, and the laddie on the diesel generator normally slept down by the, which was just slightly away from that. But your accommodation was very adjacent to that. So virtually, I mean, minutes from a general call out, everybody was on standby. And obviously, because of the radar operating from places such as Beachy Head, we were getting information that these planes were actually taking off, by the time they'd actually crossed the coast, we were virtually in operation ready to take action, whatever we could. Because, I say, they were capable, really, of... I remember very clearly saying there were, say, 40-plus planes taking off and whatever. So the big radar units at Beachy Head and that were very sophisticated and did a very good job. So that's where you got your maximum warning time. So right up from the coast, right up to London, everybody was alerted. There was bomber activity over Abbeville and raids were expected. And they meant also that the night fighter boys, they were on standby, so they would take off immediately and get into position A, orbiting the searchlight, which was a vertical beam, as I told you, within the box system, or they would go down the coast and patrol at a constant height, because they'd get a height indication from the radar, so they would probably get 2,000 or 3,000 feet above it was a clear night. And obviously...
Did you sleep in your uniforms at night, knowing that you...
Mostly, yes. You probably took your trousers off and kept your shirt and somebody, or you just had your boots and trousers to pull on and you were out within a couple of minutes.
And did you wear helmets, this kind of thing?
Yeah, yes, you wore a helmet. And you took the normal precaution, which was a gas mask and, helmet. You just took everything with you automatically.
Do you recall seeing any successful action against enemy aircraft?
Yes, we had a Heinkel bomber crash. Probably 100, 200 yards away in one village in Etchingham. It came out of the sky and plummeted into the ground and almost buried itself in the nose and about 10 feet in the ground.
And no survivors?
No, not from that. And there was another case at East Grinstead where I had a troop headquarters there and I had my own radio station at the top of a water tower. And I had a machine gun up there and on that occasion there was this odd bomber obviously in trouble coming from a raid in London. And we challenged it with our searchlight beam and it was wobbling low over its grinstead and it offloaded all its surplus bombs right in the centre of the village where we were and then crashed further on down the road. But the local cinema was hit and a lot of people were killed that particular night.
I know you were in the country, but did you ever get the feeling that the heaviest part of the raid, the heaviest time of the raid, that morale was suffering, civilian morale was suffering in any way?
Not really, because the only sort of contact we had was when families obviously were hurt of some of the, as I said, these lads were London, South East London, they would get a letter and I would arrange compassionate leave wherever possible if families were in trouble. And they would come back and obviously they would acquaint us. I mean, we knew that it was pretty bad, but when you got the first-hand information coming back about whole streets being demolished and families disappearing and things like that, this is when the thing became really serious and of great concern to the lads. But
did it give you any problems that chaps like this coming back to the unit who've lost someone were frustrated by the role they were playing because they couldn't hit back?
No, I can't recollect anybody. I mean, they were doing, more or less what they'd been told to do, and there were not a lot more they could do to frustrate the bombers, but they felt at least they were contributing towards anti-aircraft activities and hopefully keeping the enemy from getting through.
Have you any other outstanding memories of this period of time when in the Royal Artillery?
Not really, because as I say, it was fairly, I wouldn't call it humdrum, but it was a repetitive night-day job. The main thing is that wherever we were based, I was once based on Handcross Hill on the London-Brighton Road. That was another move where we used to move round the pattern of the searchlights in accordance with the requirements. And it was a wonderful old estate by a gentleman called Lord Messel. And I was invited up most mornings about 10 o'clock for coffee to acquaint his lordship of what had happened at night, and he would sit in his study and he would ask me what had gone on, and he was a fine old gentleman, and he was very considerate because we had this little wooden shack, and I remember we were there actually one New Year, and he and Lady Messel came down with some beautiful old crusted bottles of port and drank them out of the enamel mugs in our little tin hut shack and wished us a happy New Year. So this was typical of the regard that the locals had for at least what we were doing, and they were very caring. And wherever I was based, say Handcross Hill, East Grinstead, Etchingham, the local people were most considerate, helpful, and they couldn't do too much for us. They were first class.
When you moved from site to site, did you take all your equipment, searchlight, with you?
Oh yes, you had lorries, trailers, so you pulled the big diesel unit behind one, and the searchlight was put in another lorry, and you just up stakes, and you got a map reference, and you redeployed to whatever map reference it was, and set up site and moved it all again.
What was your next move?
Well, really, what happened that I'd gone on leave, and the system of the night fighter system with a vertical searchlight and radar was pretty well integrated. And I was most surprised that whilst I was at home in the middle of my leave, a telegram arrived, instructed me to report to Adastral House, which is the RAF headquarters. I hadn't a clue what this was about, so I just packed my bags and reported there. And
about what time was this? What day?
About the end of 43, probably December time, or just into the new year, this telegram arrived from Adastral House, and I reported to the RAF headquarters. There was another laddie there by the most unusual name of Clutterbuck. And we both sat in this passage outside till a squadron leader came out and took our details, yes. And we were informed that we were being taken to an RAF station and that there was a truck outside who would take us to our destination. It turned out to be West Morling, which was then one of the main fighter bases in that particular area. Ultimately, I found out that there was the Bowfighter Squadron, which was Cat's Eyes Cunningham. It was a famous night fighter race. There was the Bolton Paul Squadron. There was also an experimental squadron flying Havocs, which was an American type plane, which had in the nose actually a searchlight. It was called a Lee light and had radar fitted. This I found out afterwards. But when we arrived at the station, we were met at the gate, papers examined, and instructed by the corporal on the gate to be taken round immediately to the quartermaster's stores and to be equipped with all the necessary gear for taking flight, which we knew nothing about before we got there. Clutterbuck was dropped off at the Bowfighter Squad, and I was taken round to 264 Bolton Paul Dispersal Bay. Squadron Leader John Thorne said the brown jobs arrived. That was the Air Force name for anybody in khaki. There was an Australian pilot said, take this young man up, show him how to get in and out of the cockpit, how to cock the guns, how to fire the guns, how to bail out if necessary. Good luck, you're airborne. And within 20 minutes of arriving at West Morling, I was bouncing down the runway and was airborne in the Bolton Paul Defiant. And this was basically what they did every night, actually, not instruct people like myself. They did a night flying test. They'd been serviced, maintained, and every plane took off and landed and did a circle, circuits and bumps, fired the guns, and then they were placed at dispersal bay ready for any activities which might take place every night. And this, that was my instruction. And I was then also part of a team that, because of the way the radar operated, they had to be regularly calibrated. So whenever they felt that the radar was out of sync, they would request a plane from ourselves, or 264 Squadron or 24 Squadron, and we would then take off at dusk and fly it over the channel and then turn round and at a constant height and a constant speed fly back towards the UK so that they could actually calibrate the radar equipment along the coast. This in itself was quite straightforward until one particular, oh, there were two occasions, but one particular night the controller had forgotten we were there and we were casually flying along and the pilot was chatting to me inside my without an intercom. And he said, do you see what's happening down there, BJ, which is my nickname, Brown Job, obviously. There were searchlights and shells bursting around the plane. So he got back on Channel 5 and contacted base. And they immediately apologised. They'd forgotten about us. You're 10 miles inside France. You better turn around and come back again. So we did, and that turned out to be all right. We then came back at our constant height, constant speed. We then got the instruction of the ground, everything okay. Return to base. On another occasion, we were doing a very similar exercise for the calibration teams. We were coming back to constant height and a constant speed. And it was a beautiful moonlight night with the clouds in layers. And we were suddenly amazed to see coming towards us hundreds of planes in stepped up in three sort of massive coming towards us. We'd gone this way back to England, these were going the other way. The pilot immediately contacted base and informed them of this as well. We've just been informed, gentlemen, too. Get out of it quick. This is the first 2,000 bomber raid on the Renault factory in France. You're in the way. Get out of it. We'd have to drop down about 10,000 feet quickly and get away from this massive 2,000 bomber raid, which was then the biggest bomber raid which had actually taken place prior to the later ones in Germany. And then we got mixed up in the barrage balloons and Portsmouth and eventually got back safely to base.
When you were doing this testing business, flying at the constant speed and the constant height, what was your role in that?
Well, I was merely in the cockpit of the plane with the pilot, purely to observe that and also act as his guardian, because I was looking out behind in case he was going to be attacked if there were any Germans. But because it was an anti-aircraft unit, I was just there to observe what they were doing. And I never really was given any satisfactory reason why it was necessary to have an army officer as a liaison. But the Air Force accepted me and I just seemed to be part and parcel of the team after that. And I think, in all honesty, I was forgotten about at my old unit. And I was there till well into 44, and it was only when they were being pulled out of Westmorling to go down to Killearn and Wiltshire to be re-equipped with Mosquitoes to replace the more or less outdated Boat and Paul Defiant that somebody rang up from somewhere, wanted to know if I was still there, and they said, no, he's down in Killearn and Wiltshire, he's gone down there with the, oh, he's no right to, that's out, he's outside the, his area. So when I came back, I got an immediate call back to my unit, which I'd left, several months before to go on this liaison with the...
So there was really no clear role that what you had to do? Wasn't for any particular skills? Or
No. It was just to observe what they were doing in conjunction with the radar people and the ground forces. And that's all.
Was it the intention probably to withdraw you after you'd pick this up to go back to your unit to...
Well, I never found out, because the only reason that they eventually found out where somebody wanted to know where I was, and they rang up and they said he was down in Killearn, and they said, I'm sorry, he shouldn't be down there. If he's not at Westmorling, you better come back to the unit. And having got back to the unit, I remember the colonel calling several of us in, and all those units then, because... the main activity then was the build-up for the invasion of Europe and the build-up of forces in the Middle East and elsewhere. I had to shed a complement of officers to send them on infantry training courses. And when I arrived back, within a matter of a couple of weeks of being back, I was sent up to, or posted up to Dunbar to an infantry training course.
What time was this?
This would be early 44, probably about Easter time, because this was a full month, four weeks there. And there were all sorts of lads from the Lincolnshire, the Camerons, there were all sorts of people then who were obviously been in the UK. They were converting them to infantry training because of the need for the invasion of Europe in the Middle East and obviously Burma and whatever. The infantry were going to be in greater need of other people, but this was what it was for.
How did you feel about this, moving from the jobs and duties you had done into a one where probably you're going to have to shoot?
Well, quite frankly, at that stage, it didn't really register. It was something new. It was interesting. And certainly the infantry training was very intensive, and where you actually, under live firing conditions, where you were crawling in trenches under barbed wire in mud, under being enfiladed with a machine gun, if you put your head up, you advanced on clock timing between a barrage of mortar shelling and 25-pounder guns. You were running each day and each week throughout the month, longer distances with your full pack and equipment on. They give you a thorough physical run out, apart from the fact of being under conditions, being shelled at or mortared and under crawling under barbed wire with shells and things flying around. And you had a full month of that, and then you...
Did they teach you how to lead a platoon? Was this the kind
of thing? No, this was just virtually experiencing war conditions as needed it would be.
Do you recall any tragedies?
There was odd ones, chappies who didn't follow instructions, where got up too soon and obviously got there too when there was mortar taking place, and they didn't count and got up in time, and unfortunately the shell went off. But there were the odd one, but nothing untoward. Because there were instructors there, but you had to follow it, and it was timing. There was this creeping barrage, and you had your clock set, and you had to move forward when it stopped and get down again and then take off again.
Were there any officers from other units who, in effect, failed the course? Because
Not as far as I know. If there were, we weren't told. I can't remember anybody in our particular section there.
You were becoming upon, of course, using infantry weapons. Was this part of the course?
Oh, yes. All sorts of weapons, you know.
Which weapons were you taught?
Well, we arrived, machine guns, particularly mortars. That was mostly, infantry didn't have anything else, machine guns and mortars and rifles and revolvers and whatever.
And you were there a month, you said?
Yeah, full month.
What happened then?
The conclusion of that, we were all called back to, the Marine Hotel in Dunbar. And a typical, with a big board, list of names, read out your name, and when your name came out, so many names, you were going to the Middle East, you are going to West Africa, whatever. And as it look would happen, two chaps I'd been spent a lot of time with up there, and myself and a few more, were told on the next available transport to India.
Do you recall their names?
Oh, well, this Ken, Jock, I can't remember, but Ken Astle became a very good, he was in the Lincolnshire Regiment. He became a good pal of mine from that day onwards. And we were all then sent on a train back to London, which was rather odd because it was in the middle of the bombing period, but that was the collection centre. And we stayed there purely for direct information to which convoy we would be directed to. And eventually, I remember coming out of London because there was a raid going on at the time, and we were stuck in tunnels and the bombs dropping. And we went all the way up to Gurrock on the Clyde, and there was this massive 24,000 ton Strath boat, and we loaded on that. All ranks were on.
You hadn't been assigned a regiment at this point.
No. It was just Ken was in the ring and Jock was in the Camerons. We were going.
What date was this?
This would be about possibly July, August 44.
What are your memories of the journey?
Well, it was fascinating me in as much as that we went out down the Clyde and round the northernmost part of Ireland in the Atlantic, And of course, on the Tannoy system, we were told that there was a possibility we weren't returning to India via the Cape round South Africa, because this was the only route available because of the war in the desert in the Middle East and Malta and the shelling. The possibility they were going to chance the convoy going through. And after 48 hours, they got the green light, yes, they with sufficient air cover available, and they thought they could get the convoy through, which would substantially reduce the time taken, obviously, to get out to India rather than going round via South Africa.
Was it a comfortable journey?
Yes, it was, in as much as that it was a very big liner, and obviously there were bunks and hammocks. I mean, it was crowded with people, but the most entertaining feature of it all was the food, because they had provisioned in South Africa. So we were getting food which was virtually non-rationed, and I mean, there was virtually a menu available of food, as opposed to the army ration. This is it, eat it. And we did exercises on the deck, you know, daily, and played the usual army games on board boat until we got through the sewers and arrived at Bombay.